And you know, evangelicals don't always have a good ecclesiology, as you can't grow spiritually without community. We need the church. People get to know you. There's no more facades. The mask comes off.
Yes.
We need to be known. And then we need brothers and sisters to help us along the way to say, you need to work on this area.
Hey, everyone. I'm Bishop Jeff Bailey. Welcome to the C4SO podcast. Dennis Ockholm, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Dennis, you've written a lot of books over the years, and I think you can tell me, but maybe one of the most best known is the book Dangerous Passions, Deadly Sins, Learning to from the Psychology of the Ancient Monks. And it's such a helpful book. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what you were hoping to accomplish with the book, and also maybe a little bit of your own journey towards writing that, what some of the motivations were behind it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it kind of starts in my association with the Benedictine monastic community. Back in about 1980, I became an oblate of the Benedictines, which is talked about in another book I did called Monk Habits for Everyday People. And I was in North Dakota at the time, but then I moved to Wheaton, where I began to teach. And one of my colleagues, Bob Roberts, invited me to be in a group for several days where he put us into threesomes. We were a psychologist, a theologian, and a philosopher on the same topic. And I think he had about seven groups of threes. And for some reason, in that group of three, I was given the topic of gluttony. And I'd always wondered, why is gluttony a deadly sin? I didn't understand why it was or what it was all about. So I did my research on that. And it was great because it was in the context of the Benedictine tradition, which we can talk about goes way back with some of the people that came up with the deadly sins tradition. And while I was researching that, I also saw that I was intersecting with a lot of eating disorder literature. It occurred to me that as I researched both contemporary and ancient, that the ancients had a lot of wisdom that in some ways I thought we were rediscovering, maybe in a different context or with different language. So I wrote the paper. It turned out really, really well. Actually got it published in fact, even Christianity Today wanted a condensation of it for an issue they did. So I thought maybe I should pursue this further. I looked into the deadly sin of anger and compared that to contemporary psychological literature on anger, and found the same kind of thing happening. Well, that led me to take a week-long retreat at St. John's Monastery in Minnesota. So I traveled up there, met with a monk named Columbus Stewart, who had done a lot of work on a man named John Cashin. And Cashin is one of the three that I'll mention who was associated with this list of, well, originally eight. And he helped me make some course corrections in my thinking about these deadly sins. That was very helpful. And while I was there, I worked on the sin of envy. I'm still working on that sin personally, but anyway. So that just kept, you know, I actually published an essay on envy as a result of that. And so I thought, why not do all of them and made it a whole book.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said all of this was preceded by becoming an oblate with the Benedictines. That's not always a standard pathway for folks. So what was the pull for you? What were you looking for that led you to that pathway?
Great question. It started with kind of an existential crisis. I was for 3 years at Jamestown College in North Dakota, Presbyterian College. At that time, I was ordained in the Presbyterian Church USA, and I was hired to be both chaplain and philosophy professor. They had a minor in philosophy, so I was the only philosophy professor. So wearing both hats, I was just at wit's end later that year. And one of the persons who was helping, we had about a quarter of our students were Roman Catholic. And so a Benedictine sister was assigned to the campus to minister to them. And I got to know her really well. In fact, she became just a dear, dear friend, died a few years ago, but a dear friend. And I was at wit's end. So toward the end of the year, I said, where can I go for a retreat? And she said, well, you should go to this Benedictine monastery, Blue Cloud Abbey in South Dakota. And in North Dakota, if anybody's lived up there, you know that all you have to do is go one direction for about an hour and a half and the other direction for about 2 hours, make two turns, and you're there. So I got there And I had 3 days of an incredible experience. Again, I talk about this at the beginning of my Monk Habits book. And I came back and I thought, I need to introduce students to this. So I actually brought students there on a retreat. In fact, I even did a January term where I took 6 students who happened to be all Protestants, and we lived there for 10 days with the monks and as if we were novices. And along that way, the oblate director, and I should say an oblate is a person who identifies with a particular monastery and wants to commit to using the spirituality of and the exercises and so forth and the Benedictine rule in his or her life. And so he encouraged me, the oblate director encouraged me to look into becoming an oblate, and that's what I did. Here in California, I've transferred my oblation to a monastery close by, St. Andrew's Abbey. And yeah, that's how all of that got started.
With regards to the kind of spirituality that you're talking about in the book, this is especially for Protestants, for evangelicals, often new territory. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've been introduced to it a little bit if they've read a book by Richard Foster or Dallas Willard, but their knowledge of it is sometimes in a smorgasbord kind of way. What is it about Protestants or evangelicalism in general in which they're in some ways cut off from this tradition or find this sort of tradition especially difficult to access?
There's several ways to come at answering that. One is to say that, and I always said this to my students when I was teaching theology, that there are 3 tenses to the word save. I have been saved, I am being saved, and I will be saved. Justification, sanctification, and glorification. And I think that Protestants, especially what we call evangelicals, so that label's getting changed a little bit,
yes.
But
yes,
have focused on the first tense, have been saved, justification. And that comes out of the Reformation, of course, especially with Luther, and kind of neglect a little bit, unless they're coming out of the holiness tradition like the Methodists and so forth, the mm-hmm. sanctification side of it, I'm being saved. And I think that has a lot to do with it. Also, because of our Protestant tradition in the Reformation responding to the Roman Catholic Church, I think a lot of conservative Protestant or evangelicals are concerned not to slip into what sometimes we call a works righteousness. In fact, John Cassian was accused of being a semi-Pelagian while he was doing his writings. And I found Cassian helpful there, because Cassian at one point in what is called his conferences says he has a dialogue about between 2 people, and one asks the other, what do you need to grow good crops? Do you need good weather or labor? And it's a trick question. And he applies it to the Christian life. And I think what's happened is in a lot of evangelicalism is, yeah, we like the good weather. We're not always crazy about, you know, the labor, because again, we're a little bit afraid of that works righteousness kind of thing. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And then I also think that, you know, Luther pitted grace over against law. Now, I'm more inclined to a Reformed tradition with Calvin, and Calvin brought those 2 back together. But I think that might have something to do with it, too, because I grew up saying, you know, I'm saved by grace, not by the law. Even a good look at the New Testament shows that the law has a lot of grace in it. It shows us,
of course,
what kind of life that we're supposed to be living. It's a description of that life. So I think all of those things factor into it. And then I'll add one more thing. I love the works of Richard Foster and Dallas Willard. And I think Richard Foster has to be credited with introducing evangelicals, Protestants, to the disciplines.
Yes.
And he comes out of a Quaker tradition. So I don't think he was as guilty of what I'm going to say as Dallas Willard, who also wrote some incredible stuff. The Spirit of the Disciplines was a life-changing book for me. And I've checked this with a Willard scholar, but I don't think he has an ecclesiology.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also necessary. And, you know, evangelicals don't always have a good ecclesiology. And I've learned through studying the deadly sins, but also what has been encouraging to me from studying the monastic tradition, is you can't grow spiritually without community.
Mm-hmm.
We need the church.
Yeah.
And one of the vows that Benedictines take is the vow of stability. They will stay with the same community for the rest of their life, similar to a vow of stability we take in marriage.
Yeah, yes.
And when you're like that, people get to know you. There's no more facades. The mm-hmm. mask comes off.
Yes.
And that's what we need. We need to be known. And then we need brothers and sisters to help us along the way to say, you need to work on this area.
Yes.
In your life. So yeah. I think a lot of those things factor into what all of this tradition has to contribute to where we've come out of the Reformation.
Yes, yeah. I'm struck in thinking about what some of the barriers are for evangelicals in this regard and the ways in which their primary theological categories come out of debates in the Reformation. So much of evangelical or Protestant conceptions of salvation or soteriology are really rooted around different conceptions of the atonement, which is obviously there in Scripture and in the tradition. But in the Desert Fathers, whether it's Cassian or Evagrius or certainly the Eastern Fathers, there's an understanding of salvation that is much more rooted in the incarnation. It's not apart from the cross, of course, but that notion of Jesus's divine nature being joined to human nature and the transformation that allows the terminology of theosis or divinization that they would use, which on first glance, if someone's not heard that before, makes Protestants nervous.
Yeah, that's true.
To what degree, from your perspective, is there a corrective or a broadening of our understandings of salvation and soteriology that need to happen within the Protestant church more generally to be able to access this tradition?
That is important because there are several understandings of the atonement in the New Testament, and we kind of honed down on one. But I would say both the incarnation and the resurrection in the Eastern tradition are important because Christus Victor is also the idea that Christ is victorious and we participate in that victory. So there is a sense in which we need to recover this notion that I'm actually in Christ. My identity has changed. And that's really Pauline language too, isn't it? I'm in Christ. Paul says that over and over again. So that incarnational idea and it works both ways, doesn't it? That God took on our humanity and God knows what our humanity is all about. And at the same time, I think it's 1 Peter that talks about the fact that we are growing up into gods, so to speak. In other words, I'm becoming more like who God is in Jesus Christ, and God is known in Jesus Christ.
We participate in his divine nature.
We participate in it, exactly. So in fact, even in ordinations, sometimes Anglicans talk about that kind of thing, that your nature changes. But our nature changes, whoever we are as Christians in that sense, because we're connected in that way. There was in the tradition of the deadly sins that goes back to, as you mentioned, Evagrius and then Cassian, they both had a list of 8, and then Gregory the Great took the list, messed with it, and came up with the 7 that we have. But they all said that ascesis or discipline leads to apatheia, which is kind of a tranquility of the soul. And I think that requires some sort of sense that I'm participating in that God likeness. There's a sense of peace and joy that comes over me, and I'm becoming. And then that leads to agape, love, because if I have a tranquil soul, then I'm able to not be as concerned about me as concerned about God and others, which leads to a gnostica, knowledge. And there we get into, I think, an Eastern idea too of like almost a supernatural knowledge of who God is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think along with that, although I think we Anglicans are better at this than some other Protestants, but that involves contemplation, a contemplative life too. And I think the Eastern tradition, I think that's all wrapped up into this. I think the contemplative life is part of that. Even the appreciation of silence, you know. Yeah, so I think all of that is connected. I also think that spiritual maturity for the Eastern church is more closely connected to worship than it is for.
Yes.
A lot of Protestants.
Yes.
Those are inseparable. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Thinking about like how to make sense of this for evangelicals, and there's a particular story that we tell there around substitutionary atonement, justification, sanctification. And again, I'm aware in what you're writing about in your books on these topics and bringing the Desert Fathers and Mothers to bear on our own lives. There's a different comprehensive story that's kind of being told there in terms of even if you're talking about things like inner stillness and addressing the passions to participate more fully into Christ and these practices of watchfulness and other kinds of things that move us more deeply into this reality, this contemplative life in which we have this kind of direct access, which if we're becoming more free of the passions, allow us to move more into that. For someone for whom that was new, that wasn't their native story. But as a way of sort of bringing them into this new way of seeing what kind of life they're invited into or what kind of journey they're on. How would you narrate that for them?
I think part of it is what we've mentioned already, the silence and the contemplation that, just the practice of the monastic practice of sitting still and not being in a rush, for instance, in contemplating even scripture as you're reading it. I think that may not sound profound, but it is a profound experience. Let me put it this way. Going back to my first encounter with the monastic tradition, that first time I was in a monastery, I came away from there. It was a 3.5-hour ride home. I was in shock. I had to go to the mall on the way because in North Dakota, the mall is a long ways away from where we were living. I had to get some shoes. And when I went into the mall, it was kind of like I didn't know where I was anymore. Being in that community for 3 days, experiencing the prayers that they undergo, where they're just doing the Psalms in a very slow pace and hearing it as well as speaking it, eating together, just talking with some of the monks and their experience. I think a lot of it has to do with the way that we experience the communities that we're in. It's hard to explain, but that was, in fact, when I took 6 students to live there for those 10 days, the first thing that one of my students said when we came back and I said, what were your impressions is, he said, I didn't know how noisy the dorms were. So the whole notion of being in a community that is dedicated to seeking God, to wanting to get to know God better. And by the way, Benedictines are not a closeted community. They're very much in terms of social justice. In fact, one of Benedictine sisters, some of them even go to corporate events and vote and so forth on buy stocks and vote. They're social justice minded. I don't want people to get me wrong here, but the contemplative life is not against that. And so I think that that's what it is. One has to just experience that, perhaps at a daily office in a monastery and being there for 3 days.
That's helpful. Again, the literature is written primarily for those for monastics. So when we think about what it looks like to translate that into contemporary life and for lay people who are not able to enter into the communal rhythms of the services, what are the key insights do you think that need to be communicated for those who are trying to incorporate that into busy lives with families and jobs and modern life?
Yeah, great question. One of the things I have to do as a Benedictine oblate is I have to at least have daily office every day. So our Anglican prayer book has the materials for that. So we can sit with a morning office, a noon office, an evening office, spending time in prayer and the Psalms. The Psalter is you have to have the Psalter every day. And so I think that's part of it. I think another thing that people can do and is just pick up these volumes that are available to us of Evagrius and Cassian, Cassian's conferences. A person could just pick that up and read it. It's not hard reading. And enter into a conversation with Cassian and listen to him. Or Gregory the Great. And by the way, I did want to promote Gregory the Great's On Pastoral Care. I think it, especially for those in pastoral ministry, but anybody who wants to be in some sort of a counseling or pastoral ministry with others, is so profound. And yet it's so old. So I think that's part of it. So I think for Anglicans, we already have this available to us with the daily office. And I think that that's the first thing. And another thing then is joining a conversation by reading these works that these ancients have and letting them speak to us and just listening to them. The whole business about this book, well, the main purpose of it too, was an apologetic to say we have a bias that the newest is the better, best is the best. It's not. And there's so much richness in these ancient works, and they're available to us. You go into a Christian bookstore and you won't find them, so you have to order them.
Yes. Yeah.
But we have this prejudice, and these folks, let's put it this way. Somebody said the vices are the same, and the virtues are the same.
Mm.
They take on different forms, perhaps, these days. But these people were dealing with the same kind of life that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
And they have so much wisdom to give us.
Yeah. When you're teaching this and trying to introduce these ideas of the passions or of the deadly sins and of moving in greater freedom away from them, thinking practically, is there a place that you like to start? Now, of course, in the lists always begin with gluttony, right? Which is interesting
right.
in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where you would start, or would you start someplace else?
Yeah, that's great. By the way, I just preached a sermon on gluttony and lust.
Okay. So that's top of mind.
Yeah. And we had a couple came up to me and said, we just got engaged. And I said, well, did the sermon help you? Anyway, and by the way, those are the first two on the list. And if you can't conquer those, the early monks said, you're a goner for the other five, because those are the two that especially involve the body. But let me just kind of fumble around in a couple here. With anger, for instance, the monks would say in their own way, we have to watch out for the triggers. What are the triggers in our life that cause us to be angry? And that requires self-knowledge. So right there has to be a discipline of knowing oneself. And then once I know the triggers, I have to strategize ahead of time. What am I going to do when I hit one of those triggers? Maybe it's just having problems driving on freeways, you know, and getting upset with people. So one of the strategies that I recommended, and I was learning these from the monks in different ways, is maybe to think about who that person is that just cut me off. Maybe their mind is on a family tragedy. Maybe they just lost their job at work. I don't know. I don't know what their situation is. And then I can offer prayer. So those are that's the kind of thing with the self-knowledge first, and then strategize. The strategy has to be thought of ahead of time, how to deal with that.
What I'm hearing, though, in terms of the psychology of that, though, is the trick is to figure out a way to enter in empathetically to this other person's experience, which in doing that helps dissipate the anger that we might otherwise feel.
Right. And current psychology would tell us to do the same thing and using different language than the monks used, than the early monks used. But yes, a current psychology would say the same thing. The only thing is I'm learning this, if I'm learning it from these early monastic resources, I'm learning it first from a Christian perspective. And that was part of the apologetic of my book. Why do we start with, I've studied Rogers and Karen Horney and the Freudian tradition and others, you know, in the other tradition, and there's great wisdom there. But we often start with that in the Christian perspective and then try to somehow Christianize it. Why not start with these early, I would call psychologists.
Yes.
And see how they deal with it and then find out that, oh, yes, there's a lot of similarity to what's going on now. And then I think, let me talk about a little bit about greed because, you know, that's the only sin that Paul calls idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one sin that we probably neglect quite often in terms of what we think, because we're in a commodified culture. And so one of my friends, Bob Roberts, helped me to see that, you know, this is something for which we need community. Or Rodney Clapp, too, another friend. They both said, we need community for this. I need to find out, well, for instance, letting people know my financial situation is taboo, especially in the Christian community. Well, maybe we need to let each other know what are we doing with our finances and help with that. And then we can maybe think a little bit more accurately and assess our attitudes towards money and possessions, and then learn to be more free with our possessions and giving things away and so forth. So again, it requires first self-knowledge, and one has to unpack that. And then one has to develop some strategies for how am I going to deal with these. I recently had a book published on patience as a creative activity. And again, I would have to know to practice patience, I do have to know about my own self and where impatience comes from in my life, and then develop maybe some strategies for patience in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm struck, Dennis, though, just in listening to you describe these things, that to engage in these kinds of activities, Christians would need to have placed front and center that one of the primary works of my life is to become free of these things.
Yes.
It's the salvation now that you were talking about.
Right.
And
right.
For so many Protestants or evangelicals, there's so much emphasis on the saved,
yes,
but not the being saved. And so it makes me wonder, what does that mean for our preaching, for our catechesis, for our adult education, for the kind of cultures that we're building? How do we escape? Of course, no hint of a works righteousness. There's no earning here.
Right.
But there is a life that we long for. There's a life of freedom, and freedom from ourselves and from our worst propensities that we're weighed down by, and a freedom to move into love that require real strategy, real effort in how do I become a person less bound up with envy or jealousy or lust or anger or greed or these kinds of things. It strikes me that would require a real shift in a lot of the ways that we do things in church. Would you agree with that in terms of how that we would have to think through, how do we talk about this comprehensively?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think, of course, one way is to begin with is formation classes that you know, share a lot of this knowledge that we have in the Christian tradition. But I do think small groups can be overdone, but I think that there's a sense of accountability groups.
Mm.
Even if it's just two people getting together, maybe two guys that get together and have a relationship with each other that has accountability, I think, again, that helps us to have the self-knowledge and at the same time receive correction from friends in Christ. And so we're not always that good at, I think, developing those kind of close-knit relationships within the church.
Yeah.
So small groups or friendships and friendships is huge. I did a seminar on friendships every year while I was teaching my last 19 years. And that has to be definitely looked at. What is the Christian understanding of what friendships are? Friendships are so important in that sense. But I think it also has to start early. I think it has to, and my wife would appreciate this because she does children and family ministry, and it has to start early. Let me give you an example. So a wonderful Benedictine author, Joan Chittister, has written, amongst other books, Wisdom Distilled from the Daily. And in that book, she talks about things like the embodied sins.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, we teach children about their bodies early on. And she says, if we, in the name of discipline, are pushing and dragging around a child in the store, for instance, what are we teaching that child about his or her body? I think a lot more thought has to go into how do we begin all of this early on? How do we teach kids about their possessions? How do we teach kids about their bodies? How do we teach kids even about envy, you know, about celebrating the successes of their peers?
Yes. Yes.
Rather than being envious.
Yes.
So I think it's not just with adults. I think we adults have to care about how we train the children.
Yes. Yes.
So it's just a couple of suggestions there. Also, with regard to greed, I think with social media and all that, we've got to be careful. We're being pummeled in social media, even for things like ads and even commodifying people. And so I think we've got to be very selective and also be aware of algorithms that are haunting us.
Yes. Yeah.
And be very careful.
I mean, yes. I mean, it seems that in certain respects, every era has its own challenges and temptations, but it certainly seems like social media makes it even harder for at least some of these deadly sins or passions.
Yeah. And then freedom. You mentioned that word again. That's what we want to be. By the way, in my reading of these monks in the ancient tradition, they would say that you're never going to be completely free or completely sanctified.
Yes.
And I think we have to allow that in our lives, right? We have to say, I'm making progress. I love Calvin here. Calvin said, every one of us should be making progress daily. Some of us are going to be running and some of us are going to be crawling. It doesn't matter, he said, as long as we're making progress. And the progress is, again, going to come through working at these sins with strategies that, and I talk about strategies for each of the sins in the book, and there are others who have strategies to how to deal with this.
You mentioned earlier that the monastics said everything starts with the first two on the list, with gluttony and lust, because if you can't engage with those, with overcoming those, then you have no hope for the other five. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, well, they saw that gluttony and lust were the most deeply embodied of the sins. Not that the others don't in some way, shape, or form usually include the body of some sort. Gluttony and lust, in fact, they said that you're never going to be free from gluttony and lust your entire life from the temptation. Not that we should equate the temptation with committing the sin, but they said you're always going to have the temptation. And they even point to Jesus in his wilderness temptation. The first one was for gluttony. Turn these stones into bread.
That's right.
And then the accuser went on to other things like pride.
Yes.
So they even see that in the scriptures, that kind of. Gluttony and lust, the way that we think about our whole being. And for gluttony, one has to practice temperance in that sense, and lust, chastity, which, by the way, is not just abstinence. Abstinence, as they said, just draws lust to a truce for a while. Chastity has to do with the way that I think about my whole body and with integrity in an integral way. So it's not just about sex. It's about everything in my use of the body.
Yeah.
So that's what they, and then they said, then the other sins are more, if you will, spiritual. And maybe a way of saying that is they require more depth and in terms of the disciplines and so forth.
Yes. Yes.
They're harder to deal with.
Yeah.
But gluttony and lust, yeah. I mean, there's some things we can do in our embodied existence that handle those things fairly well. Yeah.
Yes. Last question, Dennis. What is it within Anglicanism that allows us to draw more deeply on this deeper monastic tradition or these larger strategies and ways of thinking that have developed across both the East and the West?
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, we do have Anglican monastic communities. So that's yes. That's good to know. And it's not foreign to us. Well, first of all, can I just say this? I started out as a Pentecostal, then my folks made me a Baptist, and then I entered the Presbyterian Church, and now I'm Anglican, and then I hang around with Roman Catholic Benedictines.
Yes.
And I was given a charge at my Presbyterian ordination to remember what Paul says in his prayer in Ephesians, that we know the breadth, width, depth, and length of the love of Christ and God with all the saints. So yes. We need all of the saints.
Yes.
We Anglicans have a little sliver of it. And
yes,
and I think of it as a smorgasbord. We bring our best dish to the banquet, and then we get to sample the dishes that others are bringing from their best traditions. So I think just part of it is folks being more intentional about, as Anglicans, bringing what we have in terms of our prayer book. Our prayer book is rich. Our liturgy is rich. It's one of the reason I went over from Presbyterian to Anglican is our liturgy. Our liturgy is so rich, and it comes from the prayer book in that sense. So I think I think people can go into, as I said earlier, we have the resources for a daily prayer, and we can go into that and find in there resources that will help us with all of these deadly sins. And again, the Psalter is indispensable because the Psalter deals with every emotion in every aspect of our lives. So I think but I would encourage us as Anglicans to celebrate the fact that we do have brothers and sisters in the Eastern tradition. We have brothers and sisters in other Western ecclesial traditions, and to take from those as well. And what can I incorporate into my own Anglican walk? So,
yeah.
I hope that's helpful.
That's great. No, that's wonderful. Dennis, this is such a helpful conversation, and I think it's going to be incredibly helpful to so many people. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the C4SO podcast. If you found this episode useful, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review. That's how good conversations spread.